10 o'clock, Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And 11 o'clock, A Radio Geekly begins a new series on gaming, board games, card games, RPGs, LARPing, and more. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. We hope to heck you are, in fact, a KBOO member at this time. If you're not, please do take care of that. Go now to the KBOO website, kboo.fm, and donate. Join KBOO today. Together we are stronger. Again, thanks so much, Casey Jama, for joining us this morning on Positively Revolting.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, as Ani just mentioned, Pacific Underground explores what food signifies for Asians and Pacific Islanders in America. Stay tuned for that. We have a couple of announcements, and then we'll get right to that programming. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO this morning.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a presentation from former political prisoner Daniel McGowan on April 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Portland State University. Daniel McGowan will talk about his experiences in the Earth Liberation Front, time in federal prison, and the necessity of broadening the scope of radical movements and supporting prisoners. Again, that's Daniel McGowan on April 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Portland State University, Smith Memorial Student Union, room 296. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does your food, however you define it, what does it say about you?
It says that I'm fat. That's what I thought.
You told me.
This is Pacific Underground, the radio show where Asians and Pacific Islanders take the mic into our own hands. I'm your host, Pamela Santos. This month, we thought about the language of food and how we tell our stories with food. In the segments today, we'll be exploring what food signifies for us as API Americans, what it means to us at different times of our lives, and in a lot of ways, how we perceive ourselves. Coming up, we have a roundtable about white chefs cooking Asian cuisine, some places where we go to eat Asian food, then another installment of Your English is So Good, followed by a kind of love story about food. But first, here's producer Kanan Schlesinger.
This month, we came up with the idea of digging deeper into the API lunch experience. We were being told so many interesting stories that we decided to just start recording them without any particular end in mind. It just seemed like a good idea. We thought that maybe we'd find some common threads connecting the stories, and what we wound up with is a huge, heaping plate of fried rice. It'll make sense in a sec. Just wait for it. So, long story short, we decided to play a highlight reel. Some of these interviews were done over the phone, so we apologize about poor audio quality.
Yeah, there's lots of memories of simple foods. So we go back to simple foods as we grow older. But onigiris were always kind of a treat, even though it's just rice. rice balls.
I remember a lot of times it was my grandmother, my mother's mother from Taiwan, who actually was originally from Guangdong province in China. She spoke a weird blend of languages that none of us really understood other than my mother. And so we would come home for lunch, my sister and I, and there would be my grandmother, and she'd be making something. And almost always it was fried rice. Sometimes it might be something else. And we would have this exchange where food would be presented to us, and we would eat together. But we wouldn't really have the ability to communicate back and forth. And I think that early on sort of set, you know, let me know that is really how one expresses love and affection, in especially in a Chinese culture situation. And so, yeah, so fried rice and sort of whatever else was being offered was kind of that staple, that means by which we understood each other.
I mean, my dad loves to cook, so he would always make hot pot, which was just, he'd always whip out this camping stove, and we would put the camping stove on the kitchen table and cook, you know, boil a pot of water on the kitchen table and just start adding vegetables and udon noodles and chicken. And eventually the broth would get really rich and really tasty. And then we would drink the broth afterwards as well.
I felt like it was pretty much our lunch staple because it was a good way to reuse what was left over from the previous night's dinner.
You know, my mom and dad would create these little leftover boxes to take, or little Tupperwares of leftover food to bring to school. And I think that in itself like represents some sort of kind of value.
And that led to sort of this constantly evolving, changing dish that, you know, rather than having certain staples in the fried rice, you knew, for instance, there'd probably be egg and that there'd be some sort of a meat. There definitely would be rice, pepper, you know, white peppers, a little bit of sesame oil, green onion. But beyond that, it might change in terms of maybe it was Chinese sausages, which were fantastic. Sometimes it was ground beef. Sometimes, you know, leftover ham from the previous night. Sometimes...
Did you ever do the hot dog?
Yes, we had hot dogs. If we had no Chinese sausage, it was hot dogs. And sometimes those remnants really were not... that Chinese, and they would somehow be repurposed into the fried rice.
My grandma would send me with these little rice candies that you take the wrapper off, and the inner part has a rice paper that melts in your mouth. And
the Botan candy?
Uh-huh. And people love that because, first of all, it's candy. It had a little prize in it, and everyone wanted some. So
my mom packed my lunches. I'm Hapa, and my mom is white, so I think that's probably why I achieved such a high level of white lunchness. She had this kind of formula that she always used. She always packed three things for me plus a drink. It never broke. There was never four things. It was always like a sandwich and chips and then something sweet. So this was like the 90s. So it'd be like gushers and like fruit roll-ups. My mom actually was pretty strict about not having Japanese food in the house. Like my dad would sometimes bring home rice crackers that I don't know where he got them. Like it was probably a secret mission to like a Japanese grocery store or something. But like sometimes he would bring them home and my mom would be like super pissed because she didn't like the smell of them. So they were pretty much banned from our household, and like most Japanese foods were not allowed.
Thinking this might, we were probably going to do this interview and I was like bringing this in. I'm like, I wonder if the people in the office will say anything, you know? What will be my reaction if they say, ooh, you know? Because that's the experience I grew up with, you know? Like, it's funny writing on the box or something, you know?
What did kids say? Like, did they say something to you? Was there like a visceral reaction that kids would have when you would bring your onigiri?
They'd be like, ooh, what is that? It smells like fish. And, you know, so I'd be ashamed to eat it or bring it. And I would try to like kind of not eat it in front of people, you know? And have it as a snack later.
I can't remember what grade I was in, but I do remember one kid teasing me once again about the meat in my sandwich. It's like, is that dog you're eating? And now my family is from northern China, where there isn't a tradition of dog eating. And And my family never talked about it. And so when the kid made that comment, I had like no idea what he was talking about. It's like, why would I eat dog? That's weird. Why? And it wasn't until I was an adult that I was like, oh, they were being super racist.
Yeah, there was actually this kid named Paul. I think it was, I can't remember if it was middle school or high school, that he would get made fun of. Like, he was Korean, so he'd have like bring like kimchi or like different things to school, where he finally got to the point where he was just like, okay, like, I'm just gonna troll everybody. And I remember one morning waking up and like Paul gets on the bus and like people are making a commotion. I'm like, what's going on with Paul now? And then I turned around and like he had brought like a can of maggots to bring for lunch, because he was just like, forget you guys, I'm just gonna eat these maggots for lunch, like, you're just gonna make fun of me anyway.
When I moved into an apartment building and I was like cooking all of my food for my family, that like my family would cook, and seeing my neighbors just comment on the smell, like, oh, I'm smelling such interesting smell. They were trying to be polite, but they were not, they were not enjoying it. And like all of a sudden, like cinnamon brooms just started showing up in the hallway, like all kinds of like candles that were, you know, smelled like fresh baked cookies or something. Start just trying to combat that asafoetida and cumin and ginger kind of menagerie thing.
Hello?
Grandma?
Yes.
Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay. I'm ready if you are.
Yes, I'm ready.
When you'd make a dinner or something, I just have really strong memories of being in the kitchen, in your kitchen, and smelling all the smells, the image of like kamaboko and so many, like endless onigiris.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm just really curious about what sort of memories came up when you'd make all this food when I was young.
Well, I'm probably having the same memories you were as a child. I had that same memory in my mother's kitchen. She was always so busy with, she ran the store, florist shop, and so in the evening she'd say, well, we can't cook too many things that have a strong soy sauce flavor.
Why was that?
Because it would conflict with the flower fragrances in the shop, because our living quarters was right behind the shop.
Oh, so you didn't want the flower shop that your parents worked at smelling like soy sauce.
Right. I know. I remember the butcher shop. He would always have something good for the kids that came shopping. Some days he would offer fresh hot dog just to have, and then another time he would give dill pickles. That was our treat, not candy. out of a big jar. Can you imagine digging a dill pickle, whole dill pickle out of a big jar and giving it to us?
And that was your candy?
That was the candy treat.
Even though it's something we can all come together to share in and enjoy, food can be divisive. Producer Alan Montesilio gathered the Pacific Underground crew around the studio one evening to get our thoughts on an issue we encounter a lot here in Portland. When white chefs and restaurateurs open up restaurants that serve exotic cuisine, or at least food that belongs to a culture that they're borrowing from, stealing from, or maybe just pretending to replicate. Here's our discussion.
So I feel like the whole subject of white chefs cooking food that's not theirs, or white chefs cooking Asian food, I'm always struck by how strong reactions there are to it, not just people of color or Asian folks who understandably feel very upset, but also from people reacting to it, from that this like, oh, you're making this political too? There's all these things we talk about that are controversial, but food is somehow outside of that. And obviously it's this huge category. It could be anything from Anthony Bourdain going to Manila and I'm supposed to care about that, to Andy Ricker and Pok Pok, to Bollywood theater here in Portland. let's say, if you think of a white chef opening an Asian restaurant, what are your feelings about it?
I watched this YouTube thing, and it was a white chef having this series called Market to Master, and he based several episodes on going directly to the Philippines in different regions and talking to different people about how to cook lechon, like roast pork, mm-hmm. how to do that in Cebu, how to go to different places and cook this specific. And he had so many different episodes about it, and it really bothered me. He basically got funding to go to the Philippines. For what purpose? I mean, sure, I really like to have our culture, our food, shared when I talk to other Filipinos about what food is like for them. Food is like a language of love. Like, this is how you're expressing how you care about people. And to have somebody else take that language for themselves, it feels wrong to me.
What part of that strikes you as someone taking that language for themselves as opposed to an exchange? Like, what's the difference in your mind?
So the difference in my mind is that it feels like more mainstream or more readily consumed and well-known until somebody white goes and teaches other people about it. When what I really want more is there is already an existing so-called Filipino food revolution, like a food movement made up of Filipino chefs that are actually having not only pop-ups, but have full-on restaurants and food carts all over America and kind of around the world. And they're not getting as well known as, let's say, when Anthony Bourdain decides to do a show.
It bothers you when there's only visibility when a white person does it, basically.
Yes.
Kanan, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I have thoughts. I'm not like firmly on one side of this, but I think it's all about the attitude that you take when you go into someone else's culture and you're taking these ideas and these things that have gone through an unfathomably large transformation to become what they are, that doesn't really concern you at all. So you're a guest, essentially. In temple growing up, sometimes there would be white people who would be a really close part of our community. And during festivals that would happen during like Hanumatsuri, they would don clothing, traditional Japanese clothing. And even as a very young kid, I would see that and I would see the reverence that they wore those clothes with and the acknowledgement that they weren't at home in those clothes, that those clothes like weren't necessarily theirs to tote as like as something that belongs to them. And I think something similar can be said about food. If you're opening up a restaurant, if you're just trying to capitalize off of some sort of exotic cuisine that you claim to be able to make authentically, I think there's something very morally suspect about that.
Jenna, I want to know what you think, and then Pamela.
I guess I sort of have feelings similar to Kanan, that it's hard to just make a blanket statement and say, yes, it's always problematic, or no, it's not. To me, it has a lot to do with context. I would love if we lived in this ideal world where everyone could have cultural exchange and it didn't have to exist within systemic racism and oppression. So it's this fine line that's really hard to define and to know when you're crossing it. Because I feel like, you know, I make non-Japanese food. I have an acknowledgement that I am probably putting my own cultural ideas on that piece of food. And I very much acknowledge that I'm not the authority. And so, especially because I'm Japanese, there's so much knockoff Japanese food in this country. There's, you know, other Asians opening Japanese restaurants, and there's white people opening Japanese restaurants and owning our food, like sushi bars. Sushi bars don't seem to be owned by Japanese people at all anymore. I can't figure out where all the Japanese people are eating their sushi. Like, I think we're just all eating it at home. And so I wish that it could be a cultural exchange, but I think it's a lot like like what Kanan says is that, like, for me, the problem is that the people who get the visibility tend to be the white chefs. And it's just because they're white and it's like, wow, look, you mastered this exotic thing. That's like, dude, I learned to make sushi when I was like eight, like not that.
Yeah, it's the white folks who put it on the map.
Yeah, so they're put on the map, and I think it's because they're choosing to take on this exotic thing, and that's definitely what's problematic.
You brought up the question of context while also bringing up the larger issue of white people put something on the map, and it becomes a thing, and that being a larger reflection of a systemic problem, the systemic racism in which the world in which we live. And that makes me wonder how much individual intent matters. You know, if maybe a chef goes through all this trouble and does all the things that Kanan's talking about and doesn't pretend that they're the ambassador of it and they open a restaurant, does it matter if the result is the same, that the white person gets all the credit, people arrive to Filipino restaurants
as a stamp on your cultural passport?
I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, I don't
have the definitive answer.
I
have strong feelings. I have strong feelings.
Let's hear them.
But I don't think that it's that I can't be swayed. What tends to happen, and again, I'm going to credit other smarter people. Friend of the show, Soleil Ho, host of Racist Sandwich, had talked about.
And a chef and writer, yeah.
She talked about how there's just this, it's almost as if, are we valuing the labor done by somebody who is not in that culture to replicate and produce the food of that culture, but we're not valuing when, you know, let's say Filipino people are making their own food for a restaurant and we're not giving them awards and we're not recognizing their efforts. And it was a really good question, because that's what I feel is at the heart of why I feel uneasy about anywhere that it's a white chef taking on someone else's culture. So I don't see why you can't have white chefs owning up to that this is their interpretation and it is not authentic Thai food, let's say, which is what is usually marketed for.
You're from Queens, right? The discomfort you're talking about, do you feel that in New York as intensely as you do here, or is it particular to Portland?
It's particular to Portland.
Jenna and Kanan, do you feel similarly?
I feel that way, yeah, about ramen here. Like, because I grew up in Southern California, where especially now, there's like a ramen explosion that's happening everywhere. And so, like, when I came up here and everyone told me, oh, you need to go to Hapa, you need to go to this place and that place in terms of ramen, I went there and they didn't taste very good at all. And so sushi here too, when I first moved here, oh my God, people were telling me left and right that they were the authority on sushi. They have no problem telling you that, even though you're like a Japanese person who has eaten sushi in Japan, that you don't know because Portland has the best sushi in America. It's really weird.
When I first moved here, I was asking about good places to eat, and I would be talking to someone who fancied themselves to be like pretty cool, I guess, and they would talk about the best sushi so like matter-of-factly, and the fact that it became such like not only just like a status thing like socioeconomically, but it's also like a sign of coolness. I don't know, just like knowing all, like being able to rattle off like the most exotic restaurants in town, white owned, it like that's cool. Okay. I want to go somewhere else where there's a different cool then.
So go ahead.
Here's the thing that I'm trying to figure out is that it feels like this is such an expression of white privilege, feeling like they should be allowed to do everything. And the reason why I say that is because I don't have it in my head. As much as I love Indian food, I'm not going to open an Indian restaurant.
And you know, if they did, it would end up being called fusion. Like, I think there would be an acknowledgement that it's like if I opened a barbecue joint here, it would totally be called like Jenna's Japanese barbecue joint. And even though maybe I would like try to serve ribs, I know I would end up teriyaki-ing it up and stuff or whatever. But yeah, I think if I thought, okay, I want to open something maybe it's just because I'm a person of color, so I have that sensitivity. But I would definitely acknowledge, like, this is not my food. I'm doing a fusion of this. This is not authentic. This is Jenna's, like, weird version of it. Let's see how this works. Mm-hmm. Like, not that hard. You just put a little stamp on it. Not authentic.
Kanan, I want to go back to, you were talking to me about how you find it a particular kind of annoying when someone here in Portland, I guess, talks to you about Asian food or exotic food or ethnic food or whatever as a kind of marker of coolness, as some kind of social capital. Tell me more about why that annoys you so much.
If I were to like really engage someone who says something like that, what sort of reasoning they would come up with, and then I get even more mad because...
What were the reasoning? What's that like?
In my head, when that conversation plays out in my head, and I think it's actually played out in real life too, but I can't remember anything concrete. They would talk about, you know, the quality of the food and like just because it made your mouth tingle and feel yummy, like that's what you're basing it off of. And just because you've like had that feeling at like 7 different sushi joints in Portland, you're all of a sudden like...
Do you get the same annoyed feeling when people use the word umami? Like they're so cool for using it. Like, oh yeah, I was just like full of umaminess. And I just want to be like, dude, do you even know what that is? Or why do you have to mention... Mm. Yeah, that I get that same feeling with the umami usage. Ugh.
And the other thing too is we were talking about bringing your lunch to school earlier as a person of color and getting kind of looks of people thinking that's gross when you're a kid and feeling kind of ashamed, or people think that you're thinking that your food is weird. I mean, I do want to grant that that takes on different forms in different cultures. If you know, with Indian food, it's like, oh, it smells weird, and I don't know what it'd be like for Japanese food or for Korean food. It was like, oh, kimchi is gross, and now those very same things that people of color were made fun of are now hip. It's like you made fun of us then, and you get to feel cool about it and profit off of it now. That's the weird part. That's the weirdness for me.
I should ask that class also plays into this, because when you have other communities of color trying to share their food, I think that a cultural exchange happens more informally outside of those restaurant spaces. There's other people who aren't Asian, who are other people of color here in Portland, that aren't getting to experience all of these other kinds of foods because they're limited by travel or by wherever they are in their neighborhood.
Yeah. It seems like an implicit thing underlying all of this too, that like capitalism is just really weird. Like, one of my best friends I grew up with, he's a white guy from San Francisco with like bleach blonde hair, and he loves adobo, like loves it, and he makes really good adobo. Like, I'm almost ashamed of it, but it actually makes me really happy, because it's this thing that we enjoy, that I associate with a memory that I shared with him as a kid. It's valuable to you not because you're gonna get rich off of it, but because you're my friend, and so this is valuable to you because you care about me. You've been listening to me, Alan Montecilio, along with Pamela Santos, Jenna Yokoyama, and Kanan Schlesinger. Thanks so much for listening.
Hey there. If you're just joining us now, this is Pacific Underground on KBOO. Today we're talking about food and identity. And now, here's producer Jenna Yokoyama.
Here at Pacific Underground, we love talking about what to eat and where to eat. So in the spirit of supporting API-owned restaurants, I asked everyone on the production team where they like to eat around town here in Portland, Oregon. First, Tabitha Teo and I drooled over our favorites.
Pho Hung. I've been going there since I was in high school, and oh my gosh, the pho to me is just so good. And I also like how they don't Americanize it, because the menu's changed, but it always has like tendon and I've seen like Americanized pho, which just has the muscle.
Just has the raw flank steak.
Yeah, like that flank sort of steak thing. And yeah, no tendon, no tripe, no gristle, I guess you could say. And I really like how Pho Hung has pho dishes that have the gristle or the weird stuff.
good stuff. Are there any carts that you like to go to in Portland?
So there's this one Indian food cart that I really like called New Taste of India. It's on 4th and Harrison near PSU. Oh, it's the best Indian food. Oh, I love ordering their Shahi paneer, and you can add lamb to any of the dishes. Oh, it's my comfort food. It's the best.
I wish I was like a bigger person that was into carts. I'm not really like, I don't always do the cart thing because I get like sucked into like pho hung. But I also like pho organ because it still has all the good stuff. It's got the tripe and
The tendon, the muscle.
All the stuff that takes forever to chew. Nom, 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 nom. I really like Kale, and that's downtown on Morrison. Oh my gosh, Kale is so good. It's like a Japanese curry house, and you can order cheese on top of your curry, which sounds maybe weird. It's called Doria, but what they do is they bake cheddar and mozzarella cheese on top of curry rice. And don't knock it till you've tried it. It's delicious. It's spelled K-A-L-E, so a lot of times people think it's a vegan restaurant called Kale, but no, it's just Kale. What about Chinese food?
So I grew up in Hong Kong.
This is producer Alan Montecilio.
So dim sum is what I need to make myself feel better. So there's two places in particular. One is HK Cafe on Southeast 82nd and Holgate. And then the other one is Ocean City. Dim sum is supposed to be like a sort of a long, like a kind of a leisurely thing. You know, you have old Chinese uncles reading the newspaper and having little snacks. You know, they bring out the thing, little things on the carts, and they're small portions, right? So you have a few and you read the newspaper, or you invite your whole family and you make a day out of it. My family and I, we basically rolled into some Chinese dim sum place in Hong Kong, ordered as much as we could, and just like shoved it all in our mouths really quickly and then left. So the other thing too is when I go to a dim sum, I don't really talk that much.
It's business.
It's business. And it really freaks out some of my friends here in the U.S. that they think I'm really kind of a weirdo when we go out to dim sum. I don't make conversation.
I want to see this. Like, Alan, you're so like friendly and like just so welcoming. And then all of a sudden I just imagine you just sit down and eat dim sum. And it's just like you get your game face on.
Well, I just have my priorities straight. Like, am I going to talk to people or eat Cha Siew Bao? Like, come on. It's a no-brainer. yeah. HK Cafe in Ocean City. But yeah, both those places are great.
Where do you go for Thai food?
I mean, I went to Nong's earlier today, and I was...
Nong's Come On Guy?
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah?
I've been there twice this week.
Nice. I mean, it's right here by KBOO, and it's owned by Nong, who came to this country from Thailand with $70 and two suitcases. And now she has a restaurant and food carts and her own sauce, and she went on Chopped a few times and just destroyed everyone. It was great.
After I spoke with Alan, I asked producer Pamela Santos where I should eat Filipino food here in PDX.
So there's one restaurant that has been here for years and years is Tambayan Restaurant. It's on Foster and 60th. And I just really love that it's family owned and there's always so many things. Like a Filipino restaurant has to have just a lot of different choices. So Tambayan has that going for it, where it has so many different choices and categories of what you can have: noodles, lechon. They also have a food cart that's on Division. But there's also another community center. It's the Filipino American Community Center of Portland that's on Stark and 89th. And they have a restaurant inside called Kuya's Cuisine. You can have also a couple of different choices there too. And so you have these two places that I could think of that are Filipinos making Filipino food in Portland.
At the end of the day, we all have a local favorite. Everyone's favorite bakery and banh mi shop, An Xuan. Here's Alan again.
It's called An Xuan. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Southeast 52nd and Foster Powell. You know, I'm trying to make radio and in my mid-20s, so I try to save money, and it's affordable and delicious.
What's your sandwich there?
I always get the grilled pork with lemongrass. They have like 12 or 13 different banh mi options, and some of the options are hot and some of them are cold. And I never understood people who would willingly choose the cold option. Like if you have the option to get grilled pork with lemongrass, like I'm getting that. That's normally what I get. And then I get a bao of some kind.
Producer Kane Schlesinger is also an An Xuan fan.
It's called An Xuan, and yeah, it rocks my world.
It's so good.
They have a lot of really creative banh mi options, and they have a lot of really delicious looking Vietnamese pastries. Yeah.
Okay, are we
you know
good?
What they need? They need more of here, or they need one of, at least, and I haven't found one, is like unagi. You don't like unagi, right? We've had this conversation.
It's okay.
I really like it. I would eat that regularly. Like, even if it was like prohibitively expensive, I would be like creating a little bit of a budget for it. I don't know what it is. It's like the sauce that they use on it. You know how it's like a special sauce? It's not like your average sweet teriyaki. It is sweet, but it's not teriyaki.
You're just weird.
Yeah.
That sauce is not that special. It's just like...
It's the sauce on the eel on rice, and it is special.
Okay, well, the day so that special. There's an unagi house, you'll be the first one in line.
Yeah.
Okay, well, everyone check out Kanan's Unagi Cart, coming soon to Portland. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Yeah, that was fun. Okay. And I'm hungry.
Yeah, I know, me too. That was a short list of restaurants that we here on the Pacific Underground team like to eat at when we're going around good old Stumptown, a.k.a. Portland, Oregon. For an ever-growing list of API and POC-owned restaurants in Portland, gonna send out a little love here to a fellow KBOO podcast, check out the list on racistsandwich.com. They're a podcast about race, food, and politics. You can find them online. We're a big fan of them here on Pacific Underground. So a special thanks to the Pacific Underground team for sitting down and talking with me about food. Not that it's hard to get you guys to do that.
For this month's installment of Your English is So Good, I sat down with my very close friend, Shohei Kobayashi. He's a doctoral candidate in choral conducting, currently at the University of Michigan. But before that, he lived in Portland. Shohei happened to be in town for a choir gig last week, so I asked him to speak about his experience with microaggressions. So in going through all these different spaces where you're like clearly a minority, have you ever been told your English is so good?
Yeah, it's so difficult, yeah.
Like not necessarily having received that comment itself, but something tantamount to like, hey, your English is so good in any of these spaces that you've moved through.
Oh, definitely. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, people make assumptions all the time. I have gotten that exact comment, definitely, it was like a little sort of post-concert, just like hangout at one of these singers' houses, and this new person in town came up to me, and I wanted to introduce myself because, you know, I was like, oh, I should meet this guy, and I introduced myself, and he says, oh, you know, what's that name? Where is it from? I said, it's Japanese, and he's like, oh, wow, like, your English is so good. Like my, you know, my partner is Korean and, you know, his English is blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, like I, you know, was born in California and raised there. And, you know, my parents were the first ones to come over, but, you know, I was raised here. And yet, like, there's still like surprise, you know, like even if you were born in the States, there's still like, wow, like you somehow, I don't know, like, I don't know what they're thinking. It's like somehow you transcended that, or like I don't know what exactly is behind it, and like obviously it's all like well intended, but it's just a different perspective on what the superficial makeup of what American citizens is.
So this month we're talking about food, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about how your experience with food growing up informed the way you relate to others and, to an extent, identify yourself. Can you point to a moment like where you became self-conscious or maybe even just aware of your lunch being your lunch and that it was different from what white kids were bringing to school?
Yeah, I mean, pretty early on, even in elementary school, you just note that, you know, kids might have a PB&J or they might have some Cheez-Its, or they might have, you know, whatever other snack foods, simple snack foods. So, I mean, yeah, definitely early as elementary school did I notice that I was eating other things. I think also an important detail of like this sort of Asian American like food experience is also the etiquette and like how you eat that food. and a couple moments where I was sort of self-conscious of maybe how loudly I once ate, after which I then adjusted because I was so embarrassed, or I was telling you about this time where like my brother had one of our next door neighbors over for dinner, and you know, she happened to be just like a sort of young white girl, and was like sort of almost like not offended, but but just sort of shocked maybe by like how my brother just picked up the bowl of rice and like started shoveling rice into his mouth, like from the bowl. And that's just something that you do. It's not unusual, but that's not something they do at their house. And so she was kind of, you know, put off by that somehow. And another incident when I was like at my newer sort of skateboarding friend's house, and we were eating cereal, and he just like stopped. He stopped and he told me like, "Shohei, you eat hella loud, dude." And I was like, I didn't know what to say. And he continued. He was like, "You know, if you ever come over and like have dinner with my family, like you can't eat like that in front of my mom." And I was like, "Okay, dude, like I'll adjust how I eat." And I did. I mean, I like actually consciously sort of started trying to be more quiet about my eating, but usually depending on what kind of food it was. So if it was cereal or, I don't know, pasta or something, I would try to eat that more quietly than I would a bowl of noodles or what have you, you know?
And so that often involves slurping, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, like, it's practical.
Yeah, slurping cools the liquid off.
Yeah, that's how my mom and dad told me anyway. And like, you just kind of do that.
I think it works.
Yeah, and it works. And maybe like other hot liquids too. Just like, you know, if I'm drinking coffee at home, usually I'll slurp also. But that's sort of definitely a classic sort of Asian eating etiquette that that doesn't maybe as naturally carry over into eating other foods quite as loudly.
Does that feel to you like a Shohei idiosyncrasy, or is that more a product of being raised in a Japanese American household? Because I have, you know, we have white friends that eat really loud and like eat with their
mouths
open.
That's true. The eating with the mouth open and everything. Yeah, I don't know. To be honest, I have no idea. I just have like come across enough incidents where, you know, I was eating a bowl of noodles with some other friends and they were just like quiet. And like everybody else in the restaurant's like not quiet, and I'm not quiet. And
yeah, it's like get with the picture.
Maybe so. I don't know. I mean, like, it is something that I've noticed, I guess. And yeah, not a bad thing, just a thing. You know? And like just part I don't know, just like eating culture and differences between between sort of maybe a white eating culture versus an Asian eating culture.
Does that ever make you feel otherized or alienated in a way?
I mean, I think it used to a lot more than it does now. Up until like I was like 21, going on 22, like I didn't really come to terms with the fact maybe that I am Asian, and that I was raised differently, and that I grew up with different foods, that I didn't grow up with parents that spoke native English, and that I don't have the same vocabulary of idioms, or that I don't, you know, have different cultural awarenesses and stuff. I don't think I really started coming to terms and like really try to sort of digging deep and looking backwards until after I graduated college. And I just tended to just write everything off as like, oh, well, you know, Shohei is always just sort of like a little different, so it's fine. Like, who's this Asian kid going around skateboarding and like playing guitar and like singing songs and like being, I don't know, maybe more emotionally extroverted than a typical Asian person would be earlier on, like in high school or something, because there were so many Asian people around me. I tried to find ways to make myself stand out, I guess. But, you know, I don't know how much of that filters into sort of whitewashing myself or how much of it was like really kind of just discovering my own sort of identity. Probably a little bit of both. I think kind of coming back to what we were talking about a little bit in my like sort of high school years about like maybe being a sort of more outgoing musical personality than one might expect just like looking at me as an Asian guy. I definitely like, whether or not this is the right word, I like capitalize on that. Maybe they don't expect this sort of extroverted motivator in front of them. And so I sense sometimes in maybe in a masterclass setting or whatever setting that maybe initial surprise of, oh, like, you know, he's really communicating with me in a way that maybe they wouldn't have expected at first. Maybe they would expect me to be clinical, you know, as a conductor, as opposed to somebody that is very almost emotionally motivated more than intellectually or something. Those sort of cultural stereotypes, I think, still play into what is perhaps initially expected of me as a student and as a musician. But as soon as they get to know me, then that changes.
I love to cook. I wasn't always like this. I knew how to cook in adulthood because, you know, I had to feed myself. But now, man, I love cooking Filipino dishes from scratch for myself and especially for other people.
Filipinos like feeding people.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that was old Tony Boy. Anthony Bourdain talking to Filipinos about Filipinos. But let this Filipina right here spit the truth for you. We love to be with people with our food. It goes hand in hand. So you can imagine how devastated I was when someone rejected my food. I was cooking at a friend's house. Big old house party, dancing, having fun. I don't have much money, but I could give my friend the gift of laing. It's a dish with taro leaves, coconut milk, pork, shrimp, and, well, a dozen other ingredients. I had to have a box to bring it all. And I've cooked for our friends before. At my age, I'd rather get the accolades for tasty treats than big old hangovers in the morning. One of those treats was sauteing pig ears with shrimp, garlic. I mean, oh my God, let's just say it was dang delicious. Someone I just met even pushed to be the first to try them. He posed for a picture while devouring them pig ears. And wouldn't you know, a girl I sort of know, well, she witnesses this and proceeds to puke into the kitchen sink. Now, I could say a thing or two about that, but this piece isn't about her. It's about how I feel about food. I don't have a lot of family anymore, and cooking Filipino food in the last year has been my way of reconnecting. I feel like I have a direct line to my ancestors, even if a dish isn't from our region. Oh, yeah, regions. The Philippines is composed of more than 7,000 islands. The only thing that united all these disparate tribes with their own languages and cultures was colonialism and Western imperialism. That might be the hardest part about getting people to know Filipino food. The best way I could describe it to a non-Filipino once, well, I said it was a mixture of so many different cultures and flavors. There are dishes with more Spanish influence. It's a province that part of my family's from in Pampanga. Like bringhe, which is like paella, but with sticky rice on top of banana leaves. There are Chinese and Malay influences, even dishes that have sour flavors like tamarind. I think I have to work harder to get people to understand my food, and in the process, I feel frustrated that people don't understand me. I mean, food is personal. Food is a life story encapsulated in flavor. Food is a history that you can barely remember, but your body tastes. I mean, well, I'm an immigrant. I am an immigrant child. I'm from an immigrant family. And for a lot of us, food is the language of our mother tongue that we forgot. I decided to ask some folks about food and what they thought the food of their heritage said about them. This is Nia.
Okay, so my food says it definitely describes the body that I live in. I'm half Chinese, half Vietnamese, and I eat, like, I'm a omnivore. Like I eat, you know, a lot of fresh herbs and meat and rice and, you know, the typical like Chinese or Vietnamese dish. But I would say that it's heavily classed because as far as like food goes, I would eat like certain things that like white Americans would not eat. They might even like give the repulsed look when I'm eating it or when they see it.
Nia also talked to me about what it meant to be a refugee.
We were the boat people. We traveled along the sea, along the like South China Sea, and you know, and the food that we ate was extremely poor. To this day, I get so sick of like just the smell of, you know, those like cans of sardines, you know, the metal ones with the red. Anyway, so yeah, I get really grossed out by the smell, the image of the can of sardines, because it triggers me. It brings me back to a time in which my family and I escaped Vietnam, and we were in the on the boat, and that's all that we could really eat. And for the longest time, I could not eat fish, which is a very a lot of Vietnamese people eat fish. You know, like Nip Mam, like fish sauce is our the staple dish, staple sauce that's in a lot of dishes. You know, so like for the longest time, I was just really grossed out by it because it just reminded me of the horrors of just being out in the open sea. I definitely cook my home dishes, and I've learned to really connect back to my culture and people from that.
Now, here's Tim. You remember him from the beginning of the show.
I think I would say that I'm in between two worlds, being half Japanese, growing up with a Caucasian mother, parents separated at a young age. So, you know, having that, but also really loving and enjoying cultural food like sukiyaki, which is something that's more rare for the family to make because it's so labor intensive. My grandparents would make that and would spend a lot of time doing that. So, and just really enjoying those special treats. Mostly eating typically American type food. Even Chinese food that I would go to when I was younger would be Chinese American style, you know. And then over the years, my family, especially my father, who's a big foodie, would go out and try all these different restaurants and would find these ones that had more traditional type of Chinese food, you know, the fried rice and the fried this and that, you know. We still get some of that, but. And so, kind of being in two worlds, and that there's more culturally acceptable, you know, that sushi was like, oh, you eat raw fish, you know, back in the day, and now it's like big deal, you know. They serve it at Fred Meyer's in a sushi go-round.
This is Taryn. I asked her to tell me about white kimchi as a Korean American.
Okay, so the Portuguese imported kimchi in like the 15th century roughly, and until that there was no such thing as spice in East Asia. There were like Szechuan peppers, black pepper, but there wasn't any spice because that all came from the New World. So kimchi from the Gochujang's empire's origination, like what 4600 BC, no 2600 BC up until about 1400, was all this thing of white kimchi where you just put nice spices like ginger and whatnot and daikon into your napa, and it's just another pickle. It's only a pretty recent concept that kimchi is even red and spicy like it is today. My father came from a higher aristocratic class in Seoul, and so they would eat less spicy food because spicy food was considered to be kind of beneath them, kind of in a way like, oh my gosh, we need to mask up these awful, poor cooking techniques, so let's go use some spice to cover that up. My mom was much more heavily influenced by the Japanese occupation because she was on the east coast of Korea, so her food was much more bland, not for haughty purposes, but just for the purposes of acclimation to the Japanese. And then I, as I've been growing up, I especially when I went to UCLA, I started to identify with street food. And so for me, the food of the people is the most important thing. So I like bold flavors, strong and unique combinations. And the Koreatown kind of Korean food really appealed to me. And so you kind of see these three different ways that even just what food we prefer to eat really shows our class upbringing.
This is Kusuma.
I think about this stuff all the time, and I think about it with different preparations and different ingredients and then different like eating contexts, like the family meal versus like a puja, like a ceremonial meal. And like, so I'm Indian. Well, my parents are Indian, and I grew up in Tucson, which is like 45 minutes from the border or so, about 45 miles from the border. So I grew up in kind of like in between, like kind of being like raised in like Northern Mexican culture as well as Indian, like as a South Indian, like in a South Indian household. So much of my connection to food has really been kind of connecting with my food identity through my family and then kind of my larger community that I feel like raised me. And so for me, when I think about what food has meant to my family and my community, I think a lot about the parallels between a lot of South Indian food and Mexican food.
I'm just going to skip ahead. This is the part that made me smile.
My mom will always make a comment when we're picking apart jackfruit, and she'll question, I wonder how God makes these perfect little packages in their perfect little manufacturing facility. And she'll just joke endlessly, which I guess maybe isn't even a joke. She's just being so charming and cute. But she'll just pull out each one of the packages of the jackfruit and then peel the seed and then hold the seed up to my face and say, what sweetness has God made in this small package? What sweet, perfect manufacturing facility has God made? And then she'll put it in my mouth, and it's like so darling. She's like so mystified by it. And it was so funny because then I was going through the jackfruit, like called my mom while I was like processing it, and I told her I was eating jackfruit, and I was thinking about all the times that, you know, she would you know, feel so bad for spending $5.22 on like, you know, a quarter, like an eighth of a jackfruit or something like that. And she would eat it, and my mom was telling me, like, over the phone, the same spiel about, like, the perfect manufacturing facility that God has made this, like, you know, perfect preservation of the seed, and, you know, just kind of goes off on a tangent.
So I'm finally getting to the part where this is kind of a love story. I can't get over every single time that I talk to somebody that we all have this common theme somewhere, that food was how we showed love. It's how we care about ourselves. It's how we care for the health and sustenance of the people around us. We just want to raise each other's spirits. And, you know, what better way than with food? I'm just going to have to accept that there's going to be people out there that are going to break my heart when it comes to rejecting Filipino food that I make, or maybe just don't even want to try any kind of Asian food that's too exotic for them, or just something that isn't what they were used to. And that's okay, because I love myself. Oh, and I love my food.
Well, we've come to the end of our show. We hope you've enjoyed hearing about all of these food-related stories and conversations. This week's episode was produced by Pamela Santos. Pacific Underground is Jenna Yokoyama, Alan Montesilio, Tabitha Teo, Pamela Santos, and me, Kanan Schlesinger.
huge thank you to the whole Pacific Underground team, our engineer Sam Parrish, our morning public affairs director Kathleen Stevenson, and our API community, who agreed to go on the mic. Our interviewees this month, in order of appearance, were my grandma Betty, Neil, my cousin Zane, Tim, Shashiko, Tabitha, Candace, Shohei, Taryn, Nia, Mary Lou, and Kusuma. If listening to this episode reminded you of a story from your life that you'd like to share with us, you can record a voice memo from your phone or type up a story and email it to us at pacificunderground@gmail.com. We want to hear about your experiences. As always, thanks to KBOO for studio space and so much love, and to Chops for our theme music. For more, check us out on Facebook and Twitter at PAC Underground. You can download and subscribe to our shows on SoundCloud and iTunes. Thanks everyone for listening, and thanks for supporting KBOO Portland. We'll talk to you next month.
It's 10 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, we've got Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, a Radio Geekly begins a new series on gaming, board games, card games, RPGs, LARPing, and more. And we thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking where it says donate. Thanks for taking care of that. And now we're going to go to Air Cascadia after a couple of announcements.